And now, for one last announcement of the night, I'm officially announcing I'm back. You better believe I'm back. Full time. Better than ever.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, a recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen, and joining me for this podcast, she's editor-at-large at primetimer.com and the co-host of the Extra Hot Great podcast, Tara Ariana. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing well and excited to be kicking off this new podcast with you. So this is a podcast about Succession, the HBO original series created by Jesse Armstrong. Why a podcast about Succession? Well, I watched the show and I fell in love with it. The first few episodes of season one were a little bit slow, but then I felt like it really got to me. These depictions of these characters were so indelible, and I just got really enthralled. I was very taken with the plight of some of the characters in the Roy family. Curious what your reaction was to season one and why you'd be willing to do a podcast about it, Tara.
Well, this was a show, I will confess, in the interest of full transparency, I did watch the premiere when it aired last summer, and I don't think I had totally locked onto the tone of it because I found it off-putting, which it continues to be. It's a show that pushes you away. It's very prickly. But I don't think I got at first that it was trying to be very, very darkly funny. It has the veneer of a prestige drama, these muted tones, these autumnal colors. Like, it looks very, you know, polished and serious. And then you remember, oh, right, there's this scene in the premiere where a kid gets high in his car and then pukes out the eyes of his theme park mascot head. To me, that's the touchstone moment of the show. Not really. But when I watched it the second time, when you proposed this, I thought, okay, I'm going to, so many people over the course of that first season that I know and respect and like and follow on social media, we're just in love with the show, and I always intended to come back to it and give it another chance. And I'm so glad that you've given me this opportunity to do that, because it's so great. It's like savage and mean and very British, despite being set in America. And in terms of its sensibility, of course, Jesse Armstrong is British. I devoured the show very quickly, and I'm excited to talk about season one briefly today and each episode of season two with you.
Yeah, I think one of the things you mentioned in your description just now was like how prickly it is. And that's one of the things that fascinates me about the show is virtually every single character is unlikable in the show, mm-hmm. right? And yet I continue to be drawn to the show. And when a show is able to exert that power over me, I'm very fascinated by it, right? Like I try to interrogate, what is it about the show that makes me keep coming back? What is it that makes me want to root for these people, even though I know they either will fail or that their ends are not wholesome? You know, what is it that this show does so well? And I think over the course of this season of the podcast and the show, we will hopefully have the chance to explore that. Before we begin, some housekeeping. I do want to say that we are kickstarting this season of the podcast, and we would just be really grateful if you enjoy our work, and if you enjoy Succession and want to hear us talk about Succession, if you could help support this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful for that. To do that, just go to SuccessionKickstarter.com. If you help to donate a little bit, we will give you a shout out on the air. SuccessionKickstarter.com is where you can find the Kickstarter for this podcast. We are so grateful for anyone who can chip in a little bit to help make this show a reality. We would be just very appreciative of that. And also, the show itself, you can find at SuccessionPodcast.com. That's where you'll be able to download all the episodes. And of course, if you have any feedback on the episodes, you can always message me or Tara on Twitter. At Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and she is at Tara Ariano. Tara, you want to spell it for them?
Yes, T-A-R-A-A-R-I-A-N-O.
Yeah. So that's where you can find all of our stuff for this podcast. But yeah, SuccessionKickstarter.com and SuccessionPodcast.com. Check out those places. Tara, let's start this episode by talking about season one of the show. So you want to take us through the main developments of this season?
I would love to. Rather than try and do each episode of season one before we start season two, because it's going to be soon, we're going to do a general overview of the main storylines for our characters in season one. So let's start at the beginning. Succession is about the Roy family, who are definitely not the Murdochs. Patriarch Logan Roy, who's played by Brian Cox and is certainly not supposed to remind you of Rupert Murdoch, started a gigantic media conglomerate called Waystar Royco, which is not News Corp, and which has generated obscene wealth, not just for himself, but for his four children. And you had a good question jumping off from, you know, the source of it all, Logan.
Yeah, I mean, insofar as the show has any thesis about wealth and power, what do you think it is? I will just say that one of the most interesting things I found about this show was the idea that it makes being insanely wealthy into something that's very unappealing, right? Because you are always wondering what someone's angle is. No one is ever speaking to you because they like your personality or they enjoy your company. Everyone wants something from you. And it seems like no matter what interactions any of these characters have, everyone always wants something from them, right? Whether it's their connections, their wealth, their power, like whatever it is inescapable. And I found that to be really like a compelling concept, right? Because everyone wants to be rich. Most people want to be rich, I guess. And we all imagine like we would have great uses for that money and we'd enjoy relaxing and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, being rich can be a very hellish experience, according to this show. how do you feel like Succession handles the idea of wealth and power?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very realistic in terms of the idea of having power is that you're always trying to consolidate your power and acquire more power. And I think that's definitely something we see through the course of season one and maybe something that congressional Democrats should get a sense of, because comedy doesn't work. I mean, comedy, working with your adversaries, it's pointless. You need to crush anyone who's in your way in order to get ahead. This is the point of having power, to get more of it.
Wow.
And in terms, that's,
remind me not to be trapped in the jungle with you, Tara.
That's not me. I'm just saying. No. In terms of wealth, I agree with you. It does make being rich look like not very much fun. These people do live comfortably. And considering how wealthy they are, I mean, other than in the premiere when we see them like all helicopter off just to play a game of whatever that, I guess it was baseball, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Like that is obviously excessive. And we have the moment where Roman tries to, you know, give a kid who's playing like an obscene amount of money. I forget if it's 100,000 or a million, like some just comically large amount of money. The rest of the time, they're not really splashing out. Like they have a driver, they live in a nice place, but the rest of the time they're just like, you know, trying to protect what they have, I think. And that aspect of it also makes it seem hellish, where it's like, you know, you can't enjoy it because it's always, as far as you're concerned, under attack. You always have to feel like you're in a bunker with your money.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, you're talking about how they weren't being super splashy with their money. It reminds me of, like, that Bill Gates quote, you know, about the hamburgers. Have you ever heard of this?
Maybe.
He basically is like that when you have billions of dollars, as Bill Gates, like, you know, you can afford having, like, two hamburgers instead of one, right? But it's still,
right.
But it's still, like, fundamentally the same hamburger. You know, like that it's not like your the things that give you joy are that much different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're right. They do live comfortably, but it's not like, oh, wow, like all these amazing experiences they're having that I can't ever have. Right.
Right.
There's some of that. There's some of that for sure. Like the nice house and the helicopter. But like not that much of that is shown in the actual show itself. So I do think the show's take on wealth is very interesting to me. But Tara, why don't we go through some of the individual characters in the show and talk about their plot lines?
Sure. Let's start with Connor. I think he's the eldest. He's played by Alan Ruck. He doesn't really do much. He's trying to make a real relationship with a woman named Willa, despite the fact that he originally met her when he hired her as a call girl. Her ambition is to make it as a playwright, and Connor is so desperate to get her to commit to him that he's willing to bankroll and stage her theatrical projects. But by the end of season one, he has decided, kind of out of the blue, to run for president. From his readings, which we don't hear what they are, he's decided the two biggest problems facing the country are usury and onanism, yes. Which is masturbation.
Scourges on society, for sure.
That is, first of all, obviously a winning platform. Like, good luck. So my question about him is, it made sense on Veep to have crazy, incompetent boobs running for president. And I guess in our current moment, it would be weird not to have anyone in this family of billionaires decide they had presidential ambitions for no real reason. But does Connor's run make sense for his character? It's obviously very possible this is something that's going to be dropped, you know, right away in season two, and maybe they should. But why do we think that he's doing it? That, by that, I mean, does he actually have any ideology more complex than not wanting to pay any taxes, or does he just want to stop Willa telling people he doesn't do anything, which she did not long before this announcement?
Will.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
Listen, baby, I got something I need to tell you.
Okay.
Hey, let's go over here.
Okay.
Right by the Kings. This is perfect. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, listen.
Yeah.
I think I finally found a job I want to do.
Okay, what is it?
President of the United States.
Well, okay. Wow.
Yeah?
Really?
You don't look excited.
No, sure. It sounds like a fun project.
Is this about the play?
No.
Because I loved it.
I mean, sure, you don't want to waste your money putting it on, but running for president, that's a sound investment.
Plus, I'd be planning to spend on, you know, making sure your history was cleaned up. The president, Willa, this is big.
Sure, but you know, nothing's more powerful than art.
No, sure, you know, apart from the power of the executive branch.
I mean, drama can change minds.
Yeah, but not really. You know, I could outlaw drama. I mean, I never would, but I'm just illustrating the power of the position.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure how seriously we need, you know, should we take it seriously but not literally, his desire
right.
to run for president? You know,
right.
I think that the basic idea they're trying to communicate, which is obvious to me, is that this idea of his overinflated sense of his own competence, right? That he thinks
right.
he's really good at things. And of course, the logical endpoint of that is I should be president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have echoes of that in our reality, Tara, of like somebody who feels the same way.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
But that's kind of the problem with the plotline, though, is that like no matter
yeah.
how ridiculously over the top and comical Connor may be, it mm-hmm. can't possibly measure up to what's going on in real life right now. And
right.
so I'm curious like how far they're going to ride that plot line, because I don't know that it could go that far based like
mm-hmm.
I don't know how it could not draw unfavorable comparisons with real life. And of course we saw like Veep do something similar, right? Like the characters in that show are not super competent. They're dealing in a similar political system to the one we recognize. I thought that show handled it pretty well. I'm curious,
mm-hmm.
like, can this show do the same thing? I don't know, you know?
Yeah.
I think the idea of Connor running for president fits in with the idea of him feeling like he's super competent. But beyond that, I don't know that he feels like he has a stable or coherent platform on which to run. What do you think?
I don't think he does think he's super competent. I think he thinks he has something to prove. And if he can prove this and just throw enough money at it, then he will have, you know, shut Willa up, basically. But he, you know, what happens in the finale is that he has an exchange with Gil Evis, this character that another presidential candidate, very left wing, that his sister's working for, and we'll get to him. But he like just he kind of just throws something at Gil, thinks they're having a debate, and Gil just doesn't want to engage. And Connor thinks that means he won. And so he's like, oh, if I can shut this idiot down, then I definitely should run for president. And so I don't know if it will take very long for all of his siblings and everyone else he knows to just tell him to stop. So I'm also curious to see how far they take this. If this is just, you know, a fancy that he has briefly at a party and then is like, oh, this seems like a lot of work. I don't actually want to do this.
Yeah, I could see it definitely going both ways. Although I don't agree with you about the Willow thing. I mean, I think that there is that scene in the penultimate episode where he talks to Willow because Willow has just said like, oh, Connor doesn't really do anything, and he gets really upset at her. But that doesn't feel to me like that is actually driving him to potentially run for president.
Right. You know? Maybe.
It feels like that he's mildly irritated, but that he is really just inflated with a sense of his own importance. That's what's driving the presidential run, in my opinion. And I love that scene with Gleevis because he's like, he thinks he's defeated him, but any objective observer could see that that is not what happened.
Right.
He's living in a different reality.
And, right. When we see this all the time with conservatives on Twitter, where they're like, why won't so-and-so debate me? Like, no one wants to debate you. You're dumb. Like, you have no platform. This is pointless. Like, this is just, you're just talking to hear yourself talk. And that's definitely what Connor is like.
I do think one of the things that's interesting about the Connor character is his idea towards the earlier part of the seasons of like, oh, I'm not taking any sides, when in fact he is clearly taking sides and manipulating people. Like, I think it's a brilliant depiction of that dynamic, right? Of somebody who is not only not that competent, but also like very deceptive about his own role in the family. And I appreciated that a lot. One of the most compelling characters is played by Sarah Snook, right? Her name is Siobhan. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what happened to her in season one.
Well, she's known as Shiv for short. She's a successful political consultant who early in the season gets a candidate elected to the U.S. Senate, although it's also established she's a Democrat. They're in New York. It's not hard. But her ex, Nate, played by Ashley Zuckerman, who I last saw in Manhattan, very good short live show on WGN, then recruits her to join him in working on a presidential campaign for Gleevis, played by Eric Bogosian. He's a Bernie Sanders-esque left-wing character determined to challenge Royko's media dominance, specifically as exerted through ATN, a Fox News-ish cable network. Shiv is also totally still sleeping with Nate, even though he's engaged to someone else we have yet to meet, and she is engaged to Tom Wamsgans, one of the great dumb names of a TV character, played by the British actor Matthew McFadden, who oversees Royko's hospitality companies. Just a brief, we're not going to touch on Tom that much because he's not technically a Roy, although as you pointed out before we started recording, he did offer to take her name, so maybe he is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Tom Wamsgans, played by Matthew McFadden, is like, that is one of the standout performances of season one, right? Like,
yes, such fan favorite for a good reason. Oh, he's so good. So funny.
So good.
Oh, I thought we might miss the rehearsal.
No, we don't need to rehearse. We're going to kill it.
Yeah. And did you think again about your dad and whether we want to reconsider?
It's okay.
Right. And did you think again about whether we want to go Wamsgans or Roy Wamsgans? Or, as I said, I'd be willing to just drop traditional and go Tom Roy, in fact, for myself.
Hey, I wanted to ask you something.
Uh-huh.
I could do with knowing about the bad thing in cruises. You know, the thing that meant you couldn't sleep? No?
I don't know. I just think, I just think, you know, church and state and AC/DC and Ebony and Ivory and Never the Twain Shall Meet.
Yeah, right. But you always wanted to make it public, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah. In my bones, I did.
Exactly.
But I did then destroy all the evidence, so.
This, like, brilliant combination of, like, supplicant, but also, like, willing to abuse those who fall under his power, you know what I mean? And just, like, in awe of the wealth that he stands to be a part of, but also wants to appear like he's not in awe of it. And I just think that the whole combination of that character is brilliant. There is this moment when he's talking about the prenup with Sarah Snook's character, Shiv, and he says, I had my lawyer look at, you know, the documents, and she says, you mean your mom? And she's like, you know, I'll have you know, Shiv, she's one of the best lawyers in the Twin Cities, which, like, that line just illustrates the vast gulf in status between the two characters. And there's like moments like that throughout the entire show that I just love so much. So,
well, yes, that and at the wedding when Shiv's mother, played by Harriet Walker, I think is her name. She, the great British actress, she's like, says something about it's so nice of your parents to have bought the wine. And it's so clever of them how they're telling everyone they did it. Like, they're so gauche.
Yeah.
They're like probably very comfortable in the Twin Cities, but like nowhere near prepared to like try to be on the same level as their in-laws and just being awkward.
Yeah. Just all around a super compelling depiction of that character. So many layers to that character.
Yes, yeah, Harriet Walter, excuse me.
What was that?
I said Harriet Walter, not Harriet Walker. I corrected myself.
Gotcha. But yeah.
Well, since we're talking about Tom, let's jump right to Greg, who's played by Nicholas Hirsch. He's a Roy cousin through his grandfather, Logan's mostly estranged brother, Ewan, who's played by James Cromwell. Greg is looking to move up the Royco ladder and will pretty much do whatever he's told to get there, which is how Tom ends up roping him into covering up the cover-up of a series of sex crimes and possibly worse on the company's cruise ships. And late in the season, Greg lets Kendall, who we will get to, know that he kept back some evidence from what Tom directed him to destroy for insurance purposes. But, you know, is Greg a whistleblower? I'm not so sure. And the two of these actors, Nicholas Hirsch and Matthew McFadden, are like the best comedy team of 2018. Like, their interactions are incredible.
Yeah, I think the Greg character is amazing because he just knows how to say the most awkward thing at any given point in time, which is something that I'm pretty good at myself. And that's what makes his eventual turn at the end of the season so compelling, is that he seems like a fairly innocent guy who is just trying to get a job for himself. And the idea that this family could then corrupt that character, I thought was like just a testament to the cancerous nature of this family's dynamics. Tell me what you thought.
I don't know how much of an innocent Greg is. Like, he starts pretty early on trying to angle for getting his grandfather to give him his board seat, which it seems like Ewan has been given like for mostly like polite ceremonial reasons. But Greg, like, he's trying to move up. Like, I think he is ambitious and he's just not focused. And so he does definitely shamble along with a lot of the crazy shit that's happening around him, but I think he has a venal streak too.
Yeah, I don't know, Tara. I feel like there's a difference between ambition versus, you know, Machiavellian machinations, but maybe there's not. Maybe it's all part of, like, it's all just part of a continuum, right?
Hey, so I heard.
Yeah, well.
Right, well, I just want to say good luck.
Good luck.
Yeah. You know, the place has got to change, I feel. Like, the old shit, the nasty politics, the stuff at the cruise lines. You know about that? Because I helped clean it up, you know? But...
Hey, so listen, do you know where I can find, I could use a little something?
I wish, no, but I you know, I made copies of a few key documents related to all that stuff in case I got into any trouble at all. So, yeah, I would just think, like, anybody would be wise to keep me in a good role.
Greg the motherfucking egg.
Because I feel like he's definitely ambitious, but towards the end, he's clearly expressing he's capable of blackmail, was my sense.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, getting all the documents and being told to shred them and, like, you know, to basically forge information on official company paperwork to get to them, like, he knows all of that is really shady shit. And when he starts looking at what he's covering up, like, it's upsetting. And he knows enough to, as you said, to keep some material back for blackmail purposes, but he also did it.
Right. You're right. That was earlier in the season when he kept the stuff, right? Because he knew that might come in handy someday. So maybe the transformation is not as profound as I thought. You're right. Maybe he always was kind of like that.
I mean, I think he seems more innocent because he's more of a goof. Yeah, like, he hasn't grown up in this environment. He doesn't know how to act.
Yeah. No, like, I think that's true.
he seems like he's been raised more middle class. And so he's, in a way, he's like the audience surrogate for a lot of this crazy wealth stuff that's happening around him because he's not accustomed to it. But I don't think that means he's necessarily a good guy down to his core.
Oh, I think that's a good point. Who else in the family do we have yet to mention?
Well, our main character is Kendall, who I said at the end of the Greg paragraph, but we should quickly make mention of Roman, who's played by Kieran Culkin. He's the least accomplished and most obnoxious of the Roy children, and he gets to be COO during a health crisis that Logan has, but seems extremely unqualified to do the job.
I think Roman is the character that probably changes least throughout the season.
Yep, I agree.
But I did find him to be like a pretty compelling character in the sense that, compelling is not necessarily the right word. It's like that character felt very true to life, like somebody who is just bullshitting his way through everything, and then because of his connections, he's able to survive. And he's not ineffective at bullshitting. You know,
one of the
most interesting scenes was when he's meeting with that gentleman, the Asian dude, and he gives this whole speech about what his vision is, and he basically says he has no vision, but he knows how to choose the right people. And I found that to be a very convincing speech. Like, I was like, if I was sitting on the other end of that, I might be cool with that. You know, I might actually take him up on his offer, which was, of course, to sabotage Logan.
What's your vision?
Well, it's me and Kendall.
Fuck Kendall, okay? You, what's your vision?
You know what? I ended up in a bookshop the other day, and I just started laughing.
Okay.
I was looking at all the books, cramming up all the walls, and I just thought, you know, about the olden days, all the fucking monasteries and the Bibles and the sermons and the did Jesus say this and do you mean that and all the wars and what have you, all gone. No one gives a fuck.
You're saying we're going post-literate.
People are gonna read, but the old world, it's gone. Papers gone, news gone. Tune in to ABS at 9 to be told what to think. No, over. It's all about the morsels, man. Feed me the fucking tasty morsels. Keep me interested. That is where we're headed. Tasty morsels from Groovy Hubs.
Tasty morsels from Groovy Hubs.
Look, man, I'm dumb, but I'm smart. I'm too dumb to know how to fix our whole company. I don't have the attention span. Like, this is probably the most interesting thing that's happened in my whole life, and I'm thinking about, like, six other things. But I am smart enough to know what needs changing, and I'm smart enough to spot the people who can help us, Lawrence. So are you in?
Well, I'm on the side of change.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I found him to be like the least interesting, but also obviously one of the more entertaining and one of the best drawn characters of the season. What did you think?
Yeah, he's fascinating because he just feels like chaotic evil.
Yeah.
Like that's his alignment. You don't know what he's going to do. You just know he's not smart. And the other thing about like being a good bullshitter, like that is definitely true, but he also clearly has, like, he's been rich his entire life. He knows he doesn't have to try that hard. To get wherever he wants to go. Like, the difference between Shiv and her other siblings is that, I mean, I guess not Connor because he doesn't have a job at all, but, you know, Kendall and Roman, just as far as we can tell, like, went straight from whatever schooling they had, assuming they had it, to into the company. Like, she's at least trying to do something different and make a name for herself on her own. And Roman, like, I don't think he has any thought of ever wanting to be CEO. Like, I'm sure that seems like it's way too much work. He does seem to have an awareness of his limitations, and like, he's fine to have a ceremonial title where he doesn't really have to do that much, and it's ill-defined whatever his job is. Like, the only thing we ever saw him get really passionate about through the season was around the Thanksgiving episode when the company has released a movie called The Biggest Turkey in the World, and he's furious about it. Like, he just thinks it's trash. He's mad when his girlfriend like shows it to his nieces and nephews. Like, he's just, he obviously had very strong opinions about how this movie should be marketed, if it should have happened at all. And that's like the only thing that I think he shows any kind of fire about, really.
Yeah. I think the character of Roman can be best summed up at that scene by that scene where he opens up his computer and there are like
a
thousand emails hitting his inbox, which first of all, been there, Roman. Uh-huh. But then he just like gets up and like does something else. I think it's around that time that he like jerks off in his office or whatever.
Yep.
And that sums up the entire character, I think, right?
That's excellent. Yes, I 100% agree.
Yeah. But let's talk about the MVP of season one, Kendall. What happened with Kendall in season one, Tara?
All right. Well, Kendall, played by Jeremy Strong, is the most highly placed Roy heir at Royco. In the series premiere, he has just negotiated the purchase of a web enterprise called Valter, which is definitely not Gawker, but is Gawker. The series premiere is also Logan's birthday, and Kendall is pretty sure Logan's about to retire and name Kendall as his replacement. That does not happen. What does happen is that Logan suffers a medical crisis and Kendall maneuvers to take over as acting CEO, which is when he learns that Logan has borrowed funds irresponsibly and put the company in jeopardy. So while Logan is somewhat out of commission, Kendall schemes to get him removed with a no-confidence vote from the board of directors, but fucks it up, due in large part to Roman switching sides at the last minute like a coward, and gets himself and his co-conspirators fired. A veteran of rehab for substance abuse, Kendall then falls off the wagon in a major way, but is then approached about mounting another assault on Royco with the help of one of its biggest rivals. Kendall's big mouth, however, means they have to speed up their timetable, and still everything seems to be pointing toward a win this time, until Kendall gets in a cater waiter's car to go score more drugs, drives them off a bridge and into a river, and accidentally kills the waiter. Logan's private security staff figure everything out, and Logan blackmails Kendall into dropping his takeover attempt in exchange for covering up his crime. Now, when I got to the end of the season, my thought was, Kendall, what a worm, and you had a different take.
I think Kendall is one of the most tragic figures I have ever seen in a television show. And it starts with the casting of Jeremy Strong, who just has this face that makes you want to pity him, at least mm-hmm. as played in the show, right? I mean, I've seen mm-hmm. I've seen him in other things, and he's like he can play a much bigger range, but he is just so weak and unsure of himself in this show, mm-hmm. And then the idea that like he's basically one of those characters that is destined for failure, like on a Greek tragedy level, like he's destined for failure, and you know that no matter what he tries, he will never be able to break free of his father, that they will always be kind of inextricably entwined in this toxic cycle. And so I felt like his end was very, very tragic, but that was obviously not your reaction.
Tell Sandy you're out. Tell Stewie the thing looks like a shit show. Go to the desert, dry yourself out. You have not been yourself.
There's nothing, I don't think, and I wasn't there, so.
This could be the defining moment of your life. It'd eat everything. A rich kid kills a boy, you'd never be anything else. Or, it could be what it should be. Nothing at all. A sad little detail at a lovely wedding, where father and son are reconciled.
Well, I mean, it's a fine line, right? You're right. He is tragic, and I agree with everything you said about him and Logan. It's Shakespearean, but at the same time, what characterizes a Shakespearean tragic hero is he did it to himself. All of his bad decisions are made out of hubris. And so the result is, he's the architect of his own downfall because he made terrible choices at crucial points in his life.
Really? I mean, I actually think that, like, obviously, again, there's a lot of ambition to Kendall's decisions. He wants to be CEO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, like, his points aren't necessarily wrong, right? The idea that, hey, we're going to acquire, like, Logan's decision to acquire a lot of local news stations, like, that's not necessarily a winning strategy. And
right.
And you also don't know how well put together Logan is mentally, And that's what Kendall is trying to address. He's trying to say, like, hey, the Logan that we knew wouldn't be doing these actions. He's changed after his medical issue, and mm-hmm. we want to save the company. We want to save it from Logan. Like, I actually, on some level, believes that Kendall believes that. What do you think?
I mean, I agree. Logan, it does seem from what we've been shown that Logan probably should have retired. That's definitely true. I meant more decisions like when you're about to try to take over your father's company, don't sabotage yourself by talking to one of his most trusted advisors,
right,
who's here at this wedding because he's still a friend of the family. Because you're so proud of yourself for getting this close to pulling it off that you can't shut your big mouth. Like, those are the kinds of decisions that I mean.
Speaking of sabotage, Tara, there's also the fact that he gets high or tries to get high the night before his big event. I will say, when I watched this episode the first time, I was stunned. First of all, I thought it was a brilliant finale, but I was stunned that he basically ended up killing this guy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what was your reaction? Did you anticipate that was something that might happen?
Well, no, but that's also another tragic flexion point for me, which is there is a way that you can get out from under your father's thumb if that's what you ultimately want the most. And that is, don't accept its help. Take responsibility for what you did.
Yeah.
And then don't be beholden to him. Obviously, that's the harder path. And that's the one that's going to mean you don't get to be a comfortable rich guy anymore who's bad at driving because he has a driver. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, Kendall, like all of his siblings, has been rich his whole entire life. Like, I don't think he would have the faintest idea about how to start over from a setback like this. And so he doesn't even consider it. He takes the easy way out that Logan is handing him, even though it means, you know, a loss in the short term, and that he can live to, you know, be out and free and scheming. But, you know, what is it going to do to him in the long term to have this on his conscience?
Yeah.
Because of all of the characters, I mean, I think, like, you know, we won't never know probably, but like, if Shiv accidentally killed a cater waiter, I don't feel like it would bother her that much, but Kendall is going to feel this.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how season two deals with Kendall's guilt around this. You know, we've seen so many shows and films where, like, a huge part of the plot involves guilt over some crime. I mean, we just talked about Big Little Lies season two on one of my other podcasts, Culturally Relevant, and like huge part of that season was dealing with the guilt of a huge crime that happened at the end of season one.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see if they can make that conflict compelling in season two. For Kendall. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't really know that that's like actually a choice of like, hey, go to jail and like lose everything you have and be branded a killer versus, you know, go with your father. You're right that it would allow him to escape his father, but I feel like most people would choose the not going to jail if it's a possibility, you know? I don't know. Maybe I'm just
Then I guess we haven't learned anything from Big Little Lies, which is that, like, these are the kinds of secrets that eat you up inside. It's not the easy path, but there is such a thing as, you know, as objective morality. And when you kill someone, you know, you have to take responsibility for it, I feel.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough.
I say that never having killed someone, as far as you know.
Yeah, as far as I know. So I think Kendall's story is the most tragic of season one. And it felt like it had this just amazing arc. Like the first six episodes lead up to that board meeting. I felt like we're so good. And then there's like this kind of second mini arc in episodes 7 through 10, where he like makes another go of it. And that arc was so good. I'm just so curious, like, what is the main arc of season two going to be, both for Kendall and the rest of the family? Like, how are they going to make something that interesting again? I am very curious. Anything else we want to say about these specific characters before I move on, Tara?
No, I had a sort of a side question about one of the characters that's been a Kendall antagonist, which was Lawrence. He's the CEO of Valter. And in the premiere, like, he and Kendall have, first of all, Kendall clearly knows that Lawrence is like in charge of a much cooler company than Kendall is. Like, Kendall is old media. He's trying to kiss up to Lawrence, who's like a web guy, so hard. And Lawrence like sees right through him and doesn't care, and like is even more hostile when Kendall makes his offer more hostile to like force him into taking it because it's like just so much money he couldn't possibly pass it up. But it also felt, I felt like that pilot set Lawrence up to be a much bigger adversary. He's played by Rob Yang, who I remember from a short arc on The Americans that was really great. But I felt like that the potential of that character never really played out. So I'm wondering if they're holding him in reserve for season two. What do you think?
All right. A couple thoughts. First of all, it is a delight whenever you get to see whenever I get to see an Asian American male be a total badass on screen, you know? Like it doesn't happen that often. And when it happens, yeah. I'm like, yeah, you know,
representation matters.
Give it to him. Yeah. And so when he delivers his like speech at the end of episode one, I'm like, wow, that guy is formidable. But you know, there's this idea of revenge is a dish best served cold. Mm-hmm. The kind of analogy to that in this show would be like revenge is a dish best served quietly. And yep. What I mean by that is Lawrence's big move, I felt, was promising that he would vote for Kendall. And then right. Not doing so, right?
In the board for the no confidence vote.
Yeah, and to me, that actually is more effective of a strike than like any kind of bombastic, like in your face, Kendall thing that he could have done otherwise, right? Like I felt like that he delivered a death blow at a critical time in Kendall's life, mm-hmm. and so for me, that was like him being an adversary. But I agree with you that he was not a consistent presence on the show.
All right, well, let me ask you this. I'm not in the prediction business, but let me float this and see what you think.
Yeah.
So we've established his site, Valter. It's like a Gawker type of site. What if what happens in season two is that someone leaks to Valter that Kendall killed a guy in Scotland?
I think that would be pretty interesting. And I mean, you know, this is a like a pretty clear like Chappaquiddick parallel, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I think that would be really interesting to see how that plays out, right?
Well, I mean, it's Chappaquiddick only in so much as that's the one we know about. I assume rich people are getting away with killing people all the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. If I may take a tangent here, Tara, I think that like one of the most interesting articles I ever read was about like the life of assassins and like mm-hmm. how do they live and stuff like that. And then the article, I've brought this up probably on a bunch of my podcasts in the past, but like the article ended with this cryptic statement about like, of course, these are only the assassins who like we know about and we're able
exactly.
to interview, right?
Right.
Like the best assassins in the world, A, we don't know who they are, and B, you may yep. not even know when they've done their work, right?
Right?
Like when somebody dies all of a sudden in the news, I'm just always like, I wonder if they were the victim of an extremely talented assassin, because if they were, mm-hmm. you would never even know that.
Yep.
But anyway, back to the show. I agree that the idea of a Chappaquiddick playing out, right? Like, because mm-hmm. we still, like, we had, like, Ted Kennedy had to live with that afterwards and
yep.
had to go through life. And, like, seeing that depicted in a fictional show might be really interesting. So I'm mm-hmm. actually, if that happens, which I think is very possible, I'd actually look forward to it. So,
yeah. All right. We had a few more open-ended questions just to close things out on our look back at season one. So why don't we go through them?
Yeah. So I wrote like, whose plotline are you most looking forward to next season? The first season opened up a lot of subplots for exploration, like Roman sexuality.
Yeah.
Marcia Roy's mysterious origins. But like random like thing I noticed in my season one rewatch was like at the dinner that they all had, like Marcia's relative had like taken over the animation division or something, and it was like
yeah.
a sign of her increasing dominance in the company, but like I don't think that ever really went anywhere that season,
right?
So I think it was just like a little, but I'm curious, like will that go somewhere season two? Gil Evis's mm-hmm. presidential run, and if that will have an impact on Waystar Royko at all, and yeah, the fate of Waystar Royko itself, like are there any of these that you are most hoping to learn more about in season two, Tara?
Well, the sense I have, and I won't say how, because I know that you are trailer adverse, but the sense I have is that I think Gil, at least, I mean, he might still be on the show and might be a figure on the show, but I don't get the sense that Shiv is going to continue working on his campaign. I feel it sort of seems like she's going to be brought more into Royko. So seeing her versus Kendall is interesting. I felt like those two characters didn't really get that much time in season one to play off each other. And so that's a dynamic that I would like to see developed. I think that's interesting. Roman sexuality is a good one too. I wondered about that as well, and I'm curious to know where that's going to go for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And do you have like a favorite character out of the first season? I'm curious. Like, Like, is there someone who...
I mean, I love Tom. Like, yeah, Tom is fascinating.
They're all so good. You know, they're all so good. I would say, like, probably the most virtuous one is Shiv. And that is saying something because she's not particularly virtuous.
What if the acquisitions you're making are actually bad for the country?
Oh, man, man, man. He's using you. Can't you see it? Don't let any of the bullshit overshadow your wedding.
The wedding? The fucking wedding? I don't care.
Oh, Siobhan, come on. Stop screwing around. I want to talk about you properly. Come in. I'm tired of this. You have potential. I've always thought you were the smartest.
Oh, so that's why you tried Kendall and Roman first. You know what? I am the smartest. Which is why I can see through you and this transparent little offer to buy me off.
I've always tried to do right by you, Siobhan. And maybe... maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe I should just let them come for you.
Like who?
Like... I don't know. But I hear things.
Are you threatening me?
Absolutely not.
If this is the way things are gonna go, then fuck off, Dad.
Then... I'm truly sorry.
I feel like she's probably one of the smartest ones. Does that make sense? Like,
I agree with that.
She's definitely the smartest one. And as a result, I have a lot of empathy for her. But yeah, Tom Wamscams is amazing. And probably Kendall is the character I found most compelling.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had a question here about like, who do you think shows up to the set most psyched to play his or her character?
Yeah, that's just a fun one. Who do you think is having the most fun on this show?
I think probably Kieran Culkin is my guess.
Yeah.
He just gets to like mess around.
Sitting weird in a chair, like just acting like total unchecked id. I agree. I also think Matthew McFadden, after, you know, playing characters like Mr. Darcy in The Pride and Prejudice opposite Keira Knightley, like I bet this is a big change of pace for him and it lets him do things that he hasn't had a chance to do on camera in this way. That I bet he really is having fun.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. So Tara, one thing we wanted to do on the show is like have a regular segment where we pick winners and losers for the week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of each episode, we want to kind of do like a little mini power ranking where we choose like a winning Roy and a losing Roy,
yep.
as well as a winning non-Roy and a losing non-Roy. And in this instance, for this review of season one, I think like our choices are basically aligned. They might not always be aligned, but they're aligned for today. So who is our winning Roy at the end of season one?
For all the reasons that we've already said, it's Logan. He has the biggest setback in season one and he bounces back the best. And ultimately, you know, survives a neurological issue in the premiere. He survives a no confidence vote. He survives this bear hug that we didn't really get into the details of, that Kendall tries to pull on him in the finale, and ends up with Kendall's balls in a vice. Like he's definitely the dominant Roy by the end of season one. Will he maintain that position? We will see.
I want to just talk briefly about that bear hug moment, 'cause there were so many things I loved about it. This is the moment where Kendall delivers this note to Logan, right, saying that their intentions to take over the company. And I thought that was a brilliant scene for a couple of reasons, one of which was that like Logan kind of invites him into his bathroom, you know, like while he's talking. And I just think that's like a brilliant way of showing this kind of level of vulnerability in a character without needing to write it into the dialogue, right? They just said like he's welcoming into this extremely private place where he's like not fully dressed. Like, it's not like naked or anything, but it's just very
subtle. He's getting changed for the reception, I think. He's freshening up. But yeah, you're right. It's very intimate. And for a pair of characters that have not, you know, to say the least, seemed like they had a close relationship even before the events of the show started.
So for Kendall to need to deliver the death blow in that environment, I thought was especially biting. And then Logan throws the note into the toilet and then like yells at Kendall, but then like later he needs to get the note out of the toilet.
Yeah.
And I just think that was a great encapsulation of this idea that Logan is very emotional and will display emotion when he needs to, but ultimately he knows he needs to get that note out of the toilet. Like, yep. ultimately he's not so impulsive that he's going to destroy the thing because he knows, yep, he needs to, like, act on it, right?
Read this.
What is it?
It's a proposal to buy Waystar for $140 a share. We're asking you to come to the table, open the books.
Uh-huh.
It's great value for shareholders.
Huh.
Yeah. There it is. I'm not gonna get into feelings.
Is this a fucking bear hug?
That's right.
No.
Well, fine. We have the financing. Let's just see what everyone thinks. You know, this is just the situation that has arisen, and you're very tough, and so am I, as your son. So I think this is just the way it has to be with us. I'm not sorry for what I'm doing, which is correct, but I'm sorry for how it makes you feel. And I'm sorry it had to be today. It was out of my hands. Here.
No. Fuck off.
Again, I just, like, so many ways of, like, we always talk about how we want movies and TV shows to, like, show rather than tell. And I think, mm-hmm, that's one of the things this show does extremely well. So,
yeah. And doesn't Marcia help him fish it out, too? Because that's another thing that tells us about their relationship.
Yeah. Too. So, okay. Losing Roy of the season, I think we got to acknowledge that that's Kendall, right? I mean,
definitely.
Pretty obvious, but mm-hmm, he has tried to unseat his father twice and has lost both times, one time in tragic fashion, and needs, yep, to come crawling back. And you've already explained very interestingly why that is a big setback for him, that he is, yep, not likely to come back from in the near future. So,
mm-hmm,
Kendall, the losing Roy for season one. All right. Non-Roy's. Winning non-Roy. I would have chose Tom Wamsgan for this if he was no longer a Roy, if he was not a Roy, but he, as at the end of season one, he is a Roy. So it seems as though we will not be able to choose Tom for winning non-Roy. Who do you, right, think is the winning non-Roy at the end of season one?
I have a couple of, this is cheating, I'm going to pick two. One is Gil Evis. He's very well positioned by the end of the season. It looks like he's a strong candidate in his presidential run. But I'm also going to give an honorable mention to Connor's girlfriend, Willa. And I say this without a bit of cynicism. This is 100% sincere. Her storyline is like the best case scenario for someone in a sugar baby / sugar daddy situation. Whatever she did, she played it perfectly. Now she's living in this beautiful estate in New Mexico part-time. She's getting her theater projects funded. She probably can, you know, get Connor to marry her and then divorce him in very favorable terms. Like, whatever she's doing, she needs to keep doing it because she has really set herself up very well.
Wow. You have really thought through the life cycle of a sugar baby relationship, Tara, in ways that I have not. But I can't deny that that's true. And yeah, you're right about Gil Evis, too. He has really effectively neutralized the Waystar Royko threat for the foreseeable future, right? Through, yep, through Shiv's blackmailing ways.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be some good winning non-Roys and losing non-Roys. Biggest non-Roy loser. Who do you think?
I mean, let's leave aside the ones who died.
Yep.
Or the ones who are just getting like bought off with fat envelopes of cash,
yes,
to not tell their scandalous stories. I'm going to say Francis, the Peter Friedman character. He's a trusted advisor at the top of the season that ends up getting very badly sidelined by the end. Although his last act seems to be to sell out Kendall, and who could blame him?
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I thought we had talked about Nate as a big possibility.
Oh, Nate,
well,
of course.
Yeah,
yes.
So Nate, Shiv's side squeeze, I guess, mm-hmm, is thrown out of the wedding in unceremonial fashion. And there's this kind of moment before that when he realized, he's like, what have you become? You're a monster, Shiv. You know, like kind of theatrical where he realizes that she has now control beyond his understanding of what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not only kind of shut out as the mastermind of the Gil Evis campaign, but he is also thrown out of the wedding and theoretically may never see Shiv again. Who knows?
Right.
So I would say he's a pretty big loser from season one as well.
Yeah, he had the he made the mistake of having actual convictions around a Roy.
Yep.
And that, that's not how we do.
Classic mistake. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's going to bring us to basically the end of our season one recap. Anything else you want to mention about season one before we wrap up today?
No, I think we covered almost everything. Oh, one thing. I hope for more from Carolina in season two. Dagmara Demenchik is one of my favorite actors, going all the way back to Higher Ground with Vera Farmiga. She's a lawyer or some kind of functionary high up in Royko, and she didn't get much to do in season one. So I'm hoping that she gets more in season two because she's a big fave of mine. You?
You know, we actually, one character we didn't mention was Jerry Kilman, who is the general counsel to Waystar Royko.
Yes. She's great too. Yeah.
J. Smith Cameron. I am just a big fan of, you know, really powerful women in the workplace. I married one, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And just like seeing her kind of do her thing and navigate that extremely challenging situation, I thought was a delight. I mean, one of my biggest shocks was when she, you know, says to Kendall in like episode 4 or 5, like, I've seen everything I need to see. And then they try to take Logan down in episode 6 at the board meeting, and she says like she's going to abstain. And I just thought that was a brilliant move by her. That character, I just think, is, you know, she's like the kind of like the fixer character. She's like the Varys of from Game of Thrones of Succession, right? She's always going to stick around and like do what needs to be done, and she's always looking out for herself. And I really love that character. So
yeah, you know who's still at the wedding? Jerry. You know, it's not Nate. take a note.
Indeed. All right. Well, that is it for this episode. If you enjoyed our conversation about Succession, if you're psyched for our future conversations about Succession, go to successionkickstarter.com and feel free to throw a few bucks our way. We would greatly appreciate it. You can also find more episodes of this show at successionpodcast.com. Oh, also, if you want to let us know what you think of the podcast, you can always email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. That's successionpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was produced by Tara Ariano and David Chen, and it was edited by me, David Chen, and powered by Simplecast, the first and last word in podcast management and distribution. If you are looking to start your own podcast, check out simplecast.com. And the next time we will be doing this again, is hopefully after the extremely successful completion of the Kickstarter, but also shortly after season 2, episode 1 premieres on HBO on August 11th. So thanks for listening. Until that episode airs, Tara Ariano, where can people find your work on the internet?
You can find me at everything is linked pretty much from my Twitter feed, which is at Tara Ariano, TaraAriano, and you can hear me every week on the Extra Hot Great podcast, extrahotgreat.com.
Check out all my stuff at culturallyrelevantshow.com and sign up to get emails from me at davechen.net/letters. We'll see you very soon.